Well, we're in Mark's Gospel, we're at chapter 14, and you had the passage read to you just now that we're going to look at. Apparently, I'm told that 13 of Britain's prime ministers and roughly the same number of foreign secretaries and chancellors are all descended from one man, Sir George Villiers, an Elizabethan squire. The word for that is nepotism, or jobs for the boys. You find it everywhere. You find it all around the world. And it's here in Palestine in AD 30. One family dominates the scene. The family of Annas, the high priest. He was technically high priest emeritus. When he retired, he was followed by Eleazar, and then for 18 years by Caiaphas, his son-in-law. And after Caiaphas, four more of Annas' sons got the job: Matthias, Jonathan, Theophilus, and Annas Jr. They were a powerful family. This one family dominated Jewish public life for half a century. To fall out with this family, to fall foul of this family, was to find yourself in deep trouble. And that's where Jesus is right now in the passage we're looking at. He's on trial before his life, for his life before Caiaphas. And there are three things I want you to see in the passage. I want us to think about the treachery of Judas, and then I want us to think about the trial of Jesus, and then lastly, the triumph of truth. The treachery of Judas, the trial of Jesus, and the triumph of truth. First of all, then, let's look at the way in which this all came about. Look at the treachery of Judas. Verse 43, just as he was speaking, Judas. It's interesting. Peter doesn't mention any names apart from that name here. There are others here, and we would perhaps like to know who they are. Mark doesn't tell us, for example, who drew the sword. We know who it was because the other Gospels tell us that it was Peter, but Mark doesn't tell us that. Mark doesn't tell us whose ear got chopped off. The other Gospels tell us the name of the man and that he was the servant of the high priest, but Mark doesn't tell us that. Mark doesn't tell us, for example, who this young man is who fled the scene naked. We'd like to know who that was, wouldn't we? But Mark doesn't tell us that either. The only name that features here is the name of Judas. Someone has said, you know, men call their sons and daughters Peter and Mary and James and Joanna, and they call their dogs Caesar and Nero, but nobody ever calls their child Judas. I've never met a Judas. I don't know if you've ever met someone called Judas. Judas is synonymous with betrayal and treachery. You notice how he's described here in verse 43. Just as he was speaking, Judas, one of the 12. It's interesting. Nearly everywhere that Judas is mentioned in the Gospels, that's his tag. He's one of the 12. That's how he's described. But when you go on into the very next verse, we're told he's the betrayer. He's one of the 12, and he's the betrayer. I don't know if you've ever been betrayed by someone, by a boyfriend perhaps, or a girlfriend, or a parent, or a pastor. Someone you thought was your friend, someone that you trusted. It hurts, doesn't it? And here is Judas, one of the 12, one of the inner circle. And he's the betrayer. To all outward appearances, he's a follower of Jesus. He's a member of the visible church. But in his heart, he's anything but. And that should give us pause for thought this morning. We should pause there for a moment and apply that and think about it. In the 60s, there was a television program. I'm old enough to remember it. In the 60s, there was a TV program on British TV, A Face for Judas. And it approached the subject by taking a TV producer who had a program to produce about Judas, and he searched everywhere for someone to fill that role, for just the right person with the right appearance, the right characteristics, to give him an idea of what Judas might have looked like today. And after he'd searched everywhere, high and low, the program ended with a powerful shot of the producer looking into a mirror and saying to himself, "You'll do. You'll do." Because there is something of Judas in every one of us. And there's something of us in Judas. And we need to remember that for our own spiritual safety. Don't hide behind, you know, as Presbyterians, as Calvinists, we believe, once saved, always saved. That's a bit of a dangerous doctrine. Actually, that's not quite what the doctrine is. The doctrine is the perseverance of the saints. There's a false security in that, you know, once saved, always saved. Don't assume just because once you had an experience or once you put up your hand in a meeting, or don't assume because you're part of the visible church, because you're sitting here at Ann Street and you've been sitting in that pew for donkey's years. Don't assume that you're saved. Don't. You see, for Judas, it didn't happen overnight. I mean, if you talked to him about 6 months previously, he would never have believed. He would never believe that he would have reached this point, this moment. He'd been out with the other disciples. He'd been performing miracles when Jesus sent them out to cast out demons. Judas was part of that band of disciples. He was a professing child of God. He had obeyed the outward call of Jesus to follow him. He had seemingly left all and followed Jesus. He'd tasted of the heavenly gift. He'd shared in the Holy Spirit. He'd tasted of the goodness of the Word of God and the powers of the world to come. Do you see, my friends, how important it is that you and I make our calling and election sure, that we make sure of it. Paul says to the Corinthians, if we judge ourselves, then we won't be judged. He pleads with them at the end of the letter to the Corinthians, examine yourselves to see whether you're in the faith. Don't just assume. You see, for Judas, this all happened, I think, bit by bit. We're told that he was the treasurer of the 12, and he used to dip his hand into the bag. In other words, he was caught with his hand in the till. He used to spend the money on himself, and we don't know how long that had been going on. Perhaps it had been going on all the time. But he was living a double life. He was one of the 12, and yet he was stealing the Lord's money. And his conscience, well, his little by little, he was wearing down his conscience until eventually he's totally insensitive to the warnings. Jesus is right there, face to face with him, pleading with him not to do this. And still he goes ahead. Yeah, I notice, you notice when you're driving through the city, you know how the traffic lights change. They go, I think they do, they used to. They go from green to amber to red. Is that what, I think they do that in Australia, don't they? They go from green to amber to red. And amber is meant to warn you to slow down, isn't it? You're not meant to go racing through an amber light. It's meant to warn you to slow down because the lights are about to become red. And you see, if you don't slow down and stop, then you're likely, that's how accidents happen. You become what's known as an amber gambler. There are lots of them around. And what I'm saying to you, my friends, this morning is this. I'm pleading with you, don't be an amber gambler. Don't just assume that you're a Christian, because outwardly everybody thinks that you are. Don't gamble with your soul. Make your calling and election sure. Make sure you're trusting in Jesus today. Or you say, but I was at a Billy Graham meeting 40 years ago. I don't care. Are you trusting in Jesus today? Are you repenting now of your sin? Or are you sort of justifying yourself and excusing yourself and blaming others? Are you repenting now? Because if you're not repenting now, and if you're not trusting now, you have no grounds for assuming that you're a believer. We need to be warned by this, the example of Judas, the treachery of Judas. There's something of Judas in us all. Given the circumstances, we would betray our Lord too. And notice how he does it. It's with a kiss. Isn't that just dreadful? Verse 44, going at once to Jesus, Judas said, Rabbi, and kissed him. And that's the kiss of death as far as Jesus is concerned. That's probably where that expression comes from. This is the Greek is emphatic. The Greek says he kissed Jesus ardently, long enough for the temple police to recognize him in the dark. This was the prearranged signal to betray Jesus. And so they come, the temple police, and they arrest him. And then we have this interesting sort of detail, haven't we, in verse 51. We're told everyone deserted him and fled, and a young man wearing nothing but a linen garment was following Jesus. And when they seized him, he fled naked, leaving his garment behind. Now, what's all that about? I mean, Mark's gospel is a very tight gospel. It's much shorter than all the other gospels. Mark is very lean on the information he gives us. So why does he tell us this? Why do we need to know this? We'd like to know who it was. The linen garment suggests that he was wealthy. Most commentators agree that it probably was Mark himself. And it's a bit like Alfred Hitchcock. You remember, Alfred Hitchcock always used to write himself into his own films. He always used to give himself a walk-on part in his movies. And part of the fun of watching Alfred Hitchcock's movies was to see that kind of profile walking across the screen. And maybe that's what's happening here. Maybe John Mark, who wrote this gospel, is writing himself into... I mean, if this happened to you, you wouldn't ever forget it, would you? It's his way of saying, I was there. I witnessed this. According to tradition, John Mark's mother owned the house where the upper room was. And possibly, I'm just speculating now, possibly, you know, in the middle of the night, they come looking for Jesus, they come to the house, and he's not there, and Mark just wraps the doona around him and goes running to the garden to warn. And then too late, because they've arrested him and taken him away. But that's all speculation. Maybe there's a deeper reason, a deeper significance for this. Because it's reminiscent of Amos's description of God's judgment in Amos chapter 2 and verse 16. Listen to this. Even the bravest warriors will flee naked on that day, declares the Lord. Maybe that's why this little detail is included here. Now is the judgment of the world. Now is judgment day. And even the bravest of men will flee naked on that day. And they all desert him. They all flee. And this young man flees naked. Because now the judgment of this world is about to happen. The prince of this world is about to be driven out. And that brings me then to the second point, the trial of Jesus. Plato wrote 400 years or so before Jesus. He wrote in his Republic. He imagines what would happen if a just man, if an innocent man were to come from outer space somewhere and into this world. What would happen to him? And this is what he says. This is Plato. A just man would be thrown into prison, scourged and racked, will have his eyes burnt out, and after every kind of torment, be impaled. Well, he may well have been writing about Jesus 400 years beforehand. He's describing what happened to Jesus, really, isn't he? Jesus is the only just man who ever lived. He's the only one who is without sin. And look what they do to him. Verse 53, they took Jesus to the high priest, And all the chief priests, the elders, and teachers of the law come together. Now, this was the Jewish Supreme Court. Okay? It was made up of the chief priests, the lay elders, the distinguished members of the Jewish community, and scribes. The scribes were the ones with the legal training. There were probably about more than 70 people there in that room. These were the leaders of the people. So they're going to give him a fair trial, aren't they? Look at verse 55. The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death. They were looking for evidence to put him to death. Does that sound like he's going to have a fair trial? I mean, the dice is loaded against him from the beginning, before the beginning of the trial. They've reached the verdict before they hear the evidence. They're looking for the evidence to fit. This is a gross miscarriage of justice. So desperate are they to get rid of Jesus, they break all their own rules. This is a kangaroo court, isn't it? In Jewish law, a capital offense had to be tried during the hours of daylight in public, not in the high priest's house in the middle of the night. In Jewish law, if the witnesses couldn't agree, there would be no case to answer. And you notice in the passage, as try as they may, they couldn't get two witnesses to agree. In Jewish law, the accused couldn't be condemned on his own testimony, but Jesus was. And on a capital charge, the sentencing was not done on the same day as the trial, but Jesus was sentenced to death before the morning. And so we could go on. The whole trial is a farce. My mind is made up. Don't confuse me with the facts. And so it says there in verse 64, they all condemned him as worthy of death. No dissenting voices. They all condemned him. And so here is Jesus on trial. And I want to say to you, by way of application, he still is on trial, isn't he? That court had to make up their mind about him, and so do we. This scene is still being enacted in every human community today. And in this confrontation between Jesus and his judges, everyone in that room is on one side or the other. And dare I say it, that is exactly the same here this morning. Every one of us in this room is on one side or the other. I know I was before I became a Christian. Before I was converted, as a teenager, I was 17. Before I became a Christian, I sat with the Sanhedrin. My mind was made up. I sat amongst the judges of Jesus. My mind was made up. I thought I was an atheist. See, we can't dissociate ourselves from the trial of Jesus. We can't say, well, I would never behave like that, because we do. Stella Kennedy has a famous poem which is entitled When Jesus Came to Birmingham. And the question that is raised in that poem is quite simply this: would it be any different if Jesus were to come to Brisbane this morning? Would it be any different? Would Jesus receive any fairer treatment, any better treatment from an Australian crowd on a long weekend than he did from the crowd in the high priest's house? What do you think? If Jesus were to appear in Q&A, would he get a fair hearing, do you think? Look what it says. They all condemned him. All of them. These are intelligent people. These aren't thugs. These are men who are educated in the law of God. These are sophisticated, civilized. These are the leaders. They all condemned him as worthy of death. And they slapped him, and they slapped him on his face, blindfolding him and saying, "Prophesy, who did this? Who slapped you, Jesus?" In Bach's Saint Matthew's Passion, there's a very telling point where the composer becomes a theologian, and Bach puts it to music, and he puts these words to music: "Who is it that hit you?" The choir sings. Do you know what the response is? Do you remember what the response is? "Who is it that hit you?" And the choir sings, I and my sins." That's what John Sebastian Bach would say. Who is it that hit you? Who is it that took his hand and slapped the Son of God in the face? Bach says, "It was I and my sins that did that. My wicked, evil sins did that to Jesus." See, these were men, as I say, they were religious men. They worshipped, they sung hymns and psalms, they fasted and prayed and gave alms. They were respected leaders in the community, and here they are, punching and kicking and spitting on the Son of God, behaving like a bunch of thugs. And why? "What has my Lord done to cause this rage and spite? He made the lame to run and gave the blind their sight. What injuries! Yet these are why the Lord Most High so cruelly dies." Why? Because they were jealous of his influence. Why? Because he exposed their hypocrisy. Why? Because he threatened their vested interests. And aren't we exactly the same? A friend of mine was telling me once, he was trying to explain this to an unbeliever. He said, "Look, in verse 61, Jesus says point blank, he claims that he is the Son of the Blessed One. I am," he says, when they ask him, "Do you claim to be the Son of the Blessed One?" He says, "I am." And this friend of mine was saying to the person he was talking to, "Look, is it at least possible that that could be true? Is it just for the moment, just suspend all your prejudices and for a moment just ask yourself, could it possibly be true, at least possible, that God has actually walked this earth and his name is Jesus?" "Well," said the person, "that would be very inconvenient if he did that." "What do you mean, inconvenient?" my friend said. "Well, then, my life is not my own." Exactly. Exactly. That's why some of you are on the wrong side. That's why they had to get rid of him. That's where we all are by nature, in fact. Paul says in Romans chapter 8 that the sinful mind is enmity against God and will not submit. That's how we're born. That's what we're like. We will not have this man to rule over us. And so we judge him. And we dismiss him from our thoughts and we get rid of him. And we live our lives to please ourselves. Is that where you are? Is that where you're sitting this morning? Not allowing yourself to be judged by anyone, not even Jesus. What a dangerous place to be. But by the grace of God, some of you, many of you, hopefully all of us, at some time or another have reached the point where we changed sides, didn't we? And you may remember that day when your eyes were opened to see the truth as it is in Jesus, and you repented of your repudiation of him, and you crossed the floor, and you called him Lord. And now, you, like Jesus, you are the judged ones. You see, Jesus warned his disciples, we saw this a few weeks ago in Mark chapter 13, Jesus warned his disciples that he said to them, "You will be handed over to the local councils and flogged in the synagogues on account of me, and you will stand before governors and kings as witnesses to them." What's happening to me right now, Jesus says, is going to happen to you. You will be the judged ones if you identify with me And so he gives them some advice as to how they're to behave when that happens. And maybe that's why Mark tells us this here in the gospel, so that we'll know how to conduct ourselves. How does Jesus conduct himself? Well, you remember the wisdom of Solomon? There's a time to be silent and there's a time to speak. And you see that here, don't you? At the trial of Jesus. So when the high priest calls on him to answer these false charges that have been brought against him, it says, verse 61, Jesus remained silent and gave no answer. And that's not the silence of compromise. That's not the silence of fear. It's the silence of courage and dignity. Faced with blind prejudice and stubborn refusal to look at the facts, Jesus is silent. As later on, of course, he remains silent before Herod and before Pontius Pilate, because in none of those situations was there any honesty or integrity or open inquiry. And you may very well find yourselves in similar situations, even during this week. There's a time to keep silent, and there's a time to speak, isn't there? And we need to know the difference. Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, "Don't throw your pearls before swine." Sometimes that silence is more powerful than any arguments you want to conjure up, because they're not listening. They've already made their minds up. But there's a time to speak too. And when, verse 62, when the high priest asks him point blank, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?" Jesus says, "I am." He takes the divine name, the name by which God revealed himself to Moses. "I am. Tell them, I am. Has sent you." The self-existent one, the one who doesn't need to explain himself. "I am." So Jesus, what I'm saying here is this, that Jesus is still on trial in the world today, and if you're one of his followers, you too will be on trial this week. Maybe not in a court of law, although that could very well come. It's happening to many of our brothers and sisters right now around the world. It'll come here in Australia before very long, I think. It's already happening in a small way. Maybe the day will soon come when you'll be hauled before governors and councils. But in the lecture room this week and the workplace and the schoolyard, they will accuse you as they accused him. They'll mock you as they mocked him. They'll judge you as they judged him. And if the opposition is irrational, remain silent. Don't throw your pearls before swine. But if there's a genuine inquiry and hearts and minds are open to the truth, and in my experience, God has often gone before us in these conversations, if that's the case, then don't be ashamed of Jesus. Speak up for him. Don't remain silent. Speak boldly and freely and honestly. Which brings me finally then to the last point. The treachery of Judas, the trial of Jesus, and the triumph of truth. Look what Jesus says there to the high priest in verse 62. "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?" Jesus says, "I am, and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." Do you see what he's saying? He's saying that you think you've written me off, but you will see. You will see. You will see what? What will they see? "The Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." When's that going to happen? It already has. And they saw it. They saw Jesus rise from the dead. They saw him ascend bodily on the clouds of glory to heaven. They saw him return to the Ancient of Days to receive authority over all nations and kingdoms and to receive an everlasting kingdom that can never come to an end. They saw the Spirit of God poured out on the day of Pentecost. They saw the heralds of Christ sent out to the four corners of the world. Where is Jesus now? He is seated. He is enthroned in heaven, seated at the right hand of God. What is he doing? He's sending out his heralds. What for? To bring in his kingdom. and not by clubs and swords. He doesn't issue a fatwa. He doesn't declare a jihad. He doesn't call for crusades and holy wars, but for the persuasive preaching of the gospel. And men and women and boys and girls all around this world are bowing the knee to Jesus and acknowledging him to be the Lord. You see, the Christian, don't confuse Christianity with Christendom. We conservative evangelicals do that too much, too often, too easily. Christendom is the worst thing that happened. Christianity is not a guerrilla movement. We don't bring in God's kingdom by fighting for it. We don't bring in God's kingdom by voting for it in the ballot box. We bring in God's kingdom by persuasive preaching of the gospel, evangelism. Christianity is not a guerrilla movement. Did you come against me with clubs and swords? What kind of a king do you think I am? He says when they arrested him in the garden. Put your sword away, Peter. My kingdom is not of this world. It's not that sort of a kingdom. It's not a military kingdom. It's not a political kingdom. The Christian movement is not a guerrilla movement. It's a gospel movement. And all around the world right now, the gospel is being proclaimed. And Jesus is gaining followers faster than the population in most countries. Not here in Australia. Christianity is the fastest growing religion on the planet. The media won't tell you that. But there are places in Africa and South America where people are becoming Christians faster than the population growth. You will see that, he says. Here is the vindication of Jesus. Did he claim to be the Messiah? Well, how do we know that he's the Messiah? You'll see. And we are seeing it. But you remember what the angel said when Jesus ascended through the clouds of glory on the Mount of Olives. Remember? The disciples stood there gaping, gazing into heaven, and the angel comes and sort of digs them in the ribs and says, "You men of Galilee, what are you doing? Gazing into heaven. This same Jesus will so come again as you have seen him go into heaven." So Jesus, this Jesus, you see? Do you see what Jesus is really saying to Israel's high priest? Are you the Messiah? He says, "I am the Messiah, and listen, we will meet again. Only the next time we meet, I'll be the judge, and you will be the judged." See, you don't get to judge Jesus. Jesus is going to judge you. And you will see him. If you've not made your mind up yet, let me tell you, you will see him enthroned as king and coming as judge with power and great glory. And now is the time to switch sides before that moment arrives. Now is the time to bow the knee and confess with your mouth that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father.